Hey, I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to another episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast for the Civic Media Radio Network. Today, I'm thrilled to have as my guest an old friend, Professor Kathy Kramer. Kathy is the chair of letters and science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she's also a professor of political science. Her classic and prophetic book, The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker, helped explain to a lot of people not only how Walker won here, but how Donald Trump got elected the first time around. Professor Kathy Kramer, welcome to the Wisconsin Forward podcast.
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Really appreciate you coming on. Crazy country right now. How do you see it?
It's heartbreaking in a lot of ways. And, you know, right now I'm feeling especially sore after the shootings in Minnesota.
Did they surprise you?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of my personality, where every act of hatred, every bout of political violence is still a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. And I hope it remains that way. Like, I don't want to get immune. I don't want to not feel this stuff.
Yeah, assassination should not be normal in any democracy.
No. Oh, my Lord, no.
What does it say about where we're at, do you think?
Well, I wish I had a great, succinct way of putting how I'm understanding things. But I think part of what's so hard about this situation is that there are so many different things that have led us to this point where people are shooting each other over political views. Mm-hmm. And since I wrote that book, one of the things I've been working on is trying to understand, how did we get to this state of affairs? Like, how did we get to this state of affairs where our country is so divided and people see people who lean toward the other political party as enemies?
How did we get here? What are some of those things you're focusing on?
Well, one of the things I've been doing is working on a book with my friend Larry Bartels, who's a political scientist at Vanderbilt. And we have made use of this panel data of people who were high school seniors in 1965. They were a national sample of people, and they were sampled from 97 high schools across the country. And what we did was just look at how they responded to Vietnam, the civil rights movement, women's rights, changes in the economy. Just how did their political views develop? So they're just one group of people, but we basically learned that people who went into their early adulthood with kind of traditional moral views and were from kind of just a more traditional, you know, background, tended to not embrace social change the way people who were from, more progressive moral views and people who went on to college. We sort of see it's way more complicated than just this picture, but basically back in 1965, we already see the seeds of the divides that we have right now. And one thing I know, and you as well as I, that there's public sentiment, right? But then there's what our political leaders do with it. And so that's part of the story, how people responded to the Vietnam War and such. But the other part of the story is what our political leaders have done to tap into these divides and make use of them. And the technology for doing that is just incredible these days, the way people can be targeted, and social media just makes that so much easier. Lots of things led to this point.
Yeah, you mentioned political leaders. Of course, Donald Trump has been, you know, the biggest political leader who, in my opinion, has been fueling this divide and also kind of glorifying violence in many of his talks. What role has he played?
Well, a huge role. I mean, the president of the United States of America has enormous power to draw our attention to things, issues, but also ways of behaving. I mean, he's an enormous role model. The person in that role is an enormous role model for the world. And whether or not he has caused violence, his opportunities to denounce it, they've been ample. And I mean, January 6th is just a great case in point. And he's not doing that.
What do you think the blanket pardon of the January 6th insurrectionists, what message did that send?
I think it sent a huge message that you can storm the Capitol of the United States and endanger law enforcement officers and people elected, like our national legislature, and there are no consequences. I think that's a very loud message.
Yes, indeed. And then you mentioned the killings in Minnesota, the assassinations in Minnesota. I mean, a day or two later, Trump was back blaming radical left Democrats, calling them sick of mind, saying they hate our country, say they want to destroy our inner cities, say they're threatening ICE. This language, I would have expected a president, a normal president, to try to de-escalate, especially after such an incident, but it's quite the contrary.
Yeah, I will admit I did not read or hear those messages myself, but I've heard of them. And yes, a huge part of me wishes that suddenly Trump would have a change of heart and say things like, what kind of a world do we want to live in? You know, do we want a world that's driven by hate and greed? Or do we actually prefer a world that's driven by love and generosity? I know which one I would choose. And I know which one I think most people would choose.
Yeah, but he's not like most people. He is this kind of pathological narcissist who seems totally lacking in empathy and decency and, you know, basic human feeling toward each other. And, you know, it's not only all about him in that narcissism way. He also has these colorations of authoritarians that Ruth Ben-Ghiat from NYU has been writing about. And, of course, Timothy Snyder. And how scared are you of those impulses that he seems to have?
I'm pretty scared. I mean, my political science friends talk a lot these days about whether we're already in an authoritarian situation or not. And, you know, there's this term competitive authoritarianism that lots of people talk about, which is basically you have the trappings of democracy, but basically the way things are functioning is more akin to an authoritarian country. And it's very scary because the problem with authoritarianism is once you're there, it's very hard to get back to democracy. I mean, once someone accumulates power under themselves and flaunts the, you know, just interrupts the rule of law, takes control of the judiciary, it's tough to actually have a democracy.
Yeah, I remember reading the book by the two Harvard professors, How Democracies Die, and they were saying back in 2016 that Republican leaders had a moral obligation and historical obligation to denounce Trump and tell people not to vote for Trump. That didn't happen then. It happened with a few people, obviously most notably Liz Cheney, the last time around, but it didn't succeed. And so, they came to power. And so, you mentioned how do we get back to democracy with an authoritarian in power? Do you have clues for an answer to that?
Well, I think one thing that would help a lot is if leaders in the Republican Party in particular stood up and said, these are things that we cannot agree with. We can't, stood up to Trump, basically, is what I'm kind of tiptoeing around here. I think political leaders of all stripes need to do that. And then, of course, there's always a question of, well, that's not been happening, so what's the role of the ordinary person? And I think our political leaders, there's an enormous burden on them right now to do the right thing. But I also know that just ordinary people treating each other in their daily lives with dignity and speaking up for the kind of world that they want to live in, that has enormous ripple effects too. And, you know, everything from like, quit driving like a jerk, quit absorbing the toxicity of our political environment into the way you're treating other people in your everyday life. like be the change, people. You know, live the way you think we ought to be treating each other.
Yeah, I think that was a lesson Vaclav Havel taught in the old Czechoslovakia, that, you know, act as though, you know, we are running and ruling ourselves and living in a democracy in the society we want to live in, even though we don't have the power right now, which I think is a great message. I'm also very excited about the level of protests so early on. I mean, we just are coming off the huge No Kings protests, and in small towns all across Wisconsin, there were protests. I went to the one in Stoughton, and the first person I heard talk to a friend was a 90-year-old lady who's going to be, you know, 1 month from being 91. She said, "This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, but I'm just so disgusted." And those neighbor-to-neighbor conversations in small towns, whether it's at a protest like that or whether it's in a coffee house, I think those are really important ways to do politics and to try to, you know, bring people around a little bit to the danger we're facing. You mentioned Republican leaders. I don't know anyone who's speaking out except occasionally Senator Murkowski. You know, she'll occasionally say this is, first of all, she expressed that she herself felt in danger or felt scared or felt somehow threatened at a town hall, which I thought was an alarming and a alerting kind of moment. Did you see that? And what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, and I think that's really important to say out loud, and it's just alarming, and it ought to be. Like, we need to notice that, these shootings in Minnesota are just a huge wake-up call for, I'm sure there's so many more threats going on that we're even aware of.
And I guess Tammy Baldwin and Mark Pocan were on the list, too, we found out, which is, for those of us here in Wisconsin. You know, there were 11 elected officials, I guess, in Wisconsin who are on the list, including those two. So, the thing that is, you know, I've worried for a long time. People ask me, you know, what to look out for if things start going from bad to worse. And one of the things I said was, you know, arresting Democratic officials, assassinating Democratic leaders. I've been worried for a long time about AOC, for instance, because she's so outspoken. Just the level of rhetoric is just so nasty right now that it just takes you back.
One thing I just want to note, like, I think it's precisely this kind of thing that that level of fear is so dangerous, because what it does for a lot of people, very reasonably so, is make them be silent.
Right.
Right? Like, what person in their right mind wants to be in the fray right now? But it's exactly like right now is when people need to speak up. So, for example, like, Matt, it's, you know, thank you for doing this podcast, because that's an act of courage, and we need it. And I think it's something I think about every day. People need to work, like, band together to give each other courage, because lone actors are easy targets, and it's really difficult to speak up on your own these days.
Well, thank you. And that's why I think the No Kings rallies all across the state and all across the country, we're giving people courage. We're emboldening people to engage in nonviolent political action, which is really what we need. And for those who didn't go but saw it, it may give them the impulse to go, like that 90-year-old woman in Stoughton got the impulse to go.
Yeah.
Especially when you see your neighbors who you know when you're driving by, and then you see them the next day in the coffee house and say, "I saw you were out at that protest. I couldn't make it. I felt a little scared. I've never done protests before. What was the protest like?" And then, you know, that person will be more likely to protest the next time around, because we really need them now. I mean, it's one of the few checks we have on authoritarianism is the notice to the authoritarian leader that it's not going to be easy if you want to crush people, because we have millions of the people ready to go into the streets. And that was one of the successes in the resistance in Chile to Pinochet, for instance.
Right. And the fact that they were such peaceful protests this past weekend.
Absolutely.
It's really important, too, that, like, you know, I saw here in Madison, law enforcement they certainly weren't participating in the protests, but they were there, like, making sure that people had the right to gather and speak their minds. And it was just a great reminder that, yeah, these First Amendment protections still are in place in some instances.
If you're a U.S. citizen anyway, because Trump was grabbing non-U.S. citizens and, you know, throwing him to jails in Louisiana. I mean, if they were protesting Israel's policy in Gaza, for instance, which that was one of the first signs that we're really going far down the hill. And then sending that guy to El Salvador and only bring him back at the last minute, even though the courts told him to bring him back, Abrego Garcia, and then the Marines. Bringing the Marines in the streets of Los Angeles is just, I mean, it's insanity. But I've thought for a long time that he was going to do this and invoke the Insurrection Act and get tanks in the street. Of course, we had tanks in the street in D.C. for his ridiculous military parade, but... you mentioned how important it was that the protests were peaceful. And one of the reasons they were important, because I think he was rubbing his hands together in hopes that they weren't peaceful so that he could have another pretext. I mean, the burning of those three cars in L.A. was a pretext. And, yeah, some hoodlums were throwing rocks at police cars, which is ridiculous and wrong. But that's the kind of stuff that Trump loves because it gives him an excuse. And so I just want to encourage any listener here, you know, when you're protesting, nonviolence is the moral thing to do, and it's absolutely the practical thing to do, because otherwise you're just playing right into his hands. Yeah, do you want to talk about how we talk to people who don't agree with us at this point? I mean, because not everybody who doesn't agree with us is flying a Confederate flag or has a Nazi swastika tattoo on their left bicep. Some of them do, and it might be dangerous to engage with them, but certainly in a state like Wisconsin, or, you know, 50-50 state, this country's 50-50, how important is it to try to persuade someone who might have voted for Trump but, you know, otherwise seems to be a decent person, or do we just write those people off?
Well, I'll do my best, but I think you've already mentioned a bunch of important things. I mean, one, the first step, I think a really important step, is to recognize that the image that you're getting of people on the so-called other side is a caricature, and understand that even if someone voted for Trump or leans toward the Republican Party, they're good people, by and large. I mean, most people are good. And to not allow yourself to be persuaded by the images you're getting in social media, that what you're getting is like provocation and a lot of extremity. And most people are somewhere in the middle. And most people don't think the political system in general is working for them. And people want a better system. They want better representation, right? So if you can start with that understanding, as opposed to the people on the other side are evil, the people on the other side hate me, you're doing yourself a favor. And then, you know, to just allow yourself to not try to persuade off the bat. I mean, I think with family members, it's the hardest, right? If there's political tensions within a family, that's always the hardest to have those conversations. I'll speak to those hardest conversations and just say, allow yourself to not take on the burden of trying to change somebody's mind. And instead, like, give yourself the luxury that I've had in my job, which is my job has been to understand people, right? And try to understand how they're understanding things. Mm-hmm. And it makes it in some ways a lot easier, where my questions can be, so tell me a little bit more about that. Like, so where did you hear that? And just help me understand, like, why your thoughts about wanting a more peaceful society are related to this policy stance or voting for this person. Just asking, like, actually truly asking people, help me understand your view of the world. And then, you know, I don't know, a few conversations in, maybe gently saying something like, that's really interesting how you're seeing things. You know, the way I've been thinking about it these days is like this. And don't make persuasion the point of it. Make trying to understand and just connecting with another human being the part of it. Because I think when forces, whether it be a president or what have you, kind of rip those connections, make us fear one another and hate one another, then they won. And so every time you can just make a human connection with someone and show some desire to understand who they are as a person, that's an act of resistance.
I'm glad you said that, because I've had a couple of recent experiences on Facebook, which may not be the best place, but to do this kind of civic dialogue. But I have a friend who said, why are you going to these rallies? It's about immigration, and Obama was deporting, you know, a record number of people too, so this is hypocritical. And I responded in my polite way. I said, thanks for engaging on this issue. I hope you and your family are doing well, because I know her husband really well, and they've got two daughters who are doing great. And I always like her posts on Facebook when she's talking about that. But then I said, you know, on substance, you know, Obama wasn't bringing the Marines into the street. Obama wasn't, you know, sending people to prisons when judges said you can't do that. Just along those lines. And then some of my other friends who share my own political beliefs just, you know, said nasty things about her on Facebook. And it just wasn't a great exchange after that. And I didn't follow up except to send her a private message saying, let's get coffee sometime and talk about it. Might be a better way to carry on this conversation. But I've had people who say, you know, one person, why is this person Matt's friend? And I had another person in a different circumstance. When I said one of my friends voted for Trump, he said, get different friends. And I think that impulse, and maybe it's more common in Madison, where you can, you know, go a couple of weeks without bumping into a Trump supporter if you live in the real Democratic neighborhoods. It might be easier in Madison to have that feeling. I think for people who live in other towns, who engage day to day with people who voted for Trump, and they know, you know, these aren't the real, you know, Proud Boy haters. These are folks who are members of the community that we enjoy being with most of the time. I think folks in those places have a better understanding of what you were just saying, that we are reacting to stereotypes, to caricatures of people on the other side. And it is important to engage just for decent human interaction with people without, you know, writing them out of the book of life, which is what, you know, some of the Facebook folks wanted me to do. But I just wonder what the success rate is on this, though, politically, because, for instance, I'm thinking back to the election in 2024 and Liz Cheney and trying to bring a lot of, you know, decent Republicans around. And when all was said and done, I don't know how many of them came around, but not enough anyway. So there seems to be a political split, too, from some of my more analytical friends who say, well, you can talk all day long, Matt, with your friends who voted for Trump, but it's not going to be doing a darn bit of good. Why don't you focus on getting the base out or the non-voters out or things like that? How do you respond to such a critique?
I rely on my deep commitment to the idea that love is better than hate. And if the strategy is we have to use tactics that draw people's attention to how much they dislike other groups of people, that, I mean, what's the point? Like, that's that, you know, I guess I've said this a bunch of times, but that is not the world I want to live in. And I understand that that is politically more effective. Absolutely. That is going to win elections over let's see the good in each other. Probably in this environment, in this communication environment, the strategy of mobilizing people by reminding them how much they dislike the other side is effective. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't get us to a society in which people are well, are simply like living lives that have meaning, in which they have what they need in order to do simple things like spend time with their families, have a little bit of leisure time, and be healthy. I don't care what's good political strategy. Like, what I care is, like, human beings have to figure this out. Like, we have to figure out how to actually live fulfilling lives.
And the so-called good political strategy short-term may be a bad strategy for civic health long-term, which is what you're getting
at. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I deeply believe that. So do we all become extinct in the meantime?
Hope not.
I hope not.
Kathy Kramer, you know, your book, Politics of Resentment, talked about the resentment, especially of white working class folks or white rural folks. You mentioned, you know, people still feel like the system's not working for them. Part of the problem in 2024 is that I thought Kamala Harris, and I don't blame Kamala Harris for anything. I thought she was given an impossible task, and I liked her energy, her joy, and her class. But she, in a sense, became the institutional candidate. And Donald Trump, again, was the candidate from the outside, oddly. And people are sick of politics and politicians as usual. And so becoming the institutional candidate may not have been the way to go. You know, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump always talk about the system being rigged. And I think that's what resonates with people who feel like the system isn't working for them. And that's why you had that weird overlap of people who went for Bernie and then voted for Trump. But the system really isn't working. I mean, those people are right in some ways that the system isn't working for them, even though some rural communities, as you point out, are getting more tax benefits than average people in cities. But at the gut level, they understand that, you know, their economy's been hollowed out and their circumstance isn't great. How do we address those resentments that still are there and still are powerful?
Well, I think a huge part of it is economics, right? In the way our economy functions. And I agree with everything you said. And white working class people or people in rural communities in the United States are not the only ones who feel that the system is rigged and who, in fact, are not being represented by our policymakers. I mean, time and again, if one of the things that political science does understand these days is that when policies are made, it's typically the preferences. I mean, time and again, it's the preferences of people who are the wealthiest in the country that are represented. There's lots of things on which people across the income spectrum agree on, but when we don't, it's the preferences of the richest people that get put into policy. And I think that is going to take a lot, and again, is going to take a lot of willpower, people in government, people in the private sector, just doing things that are, again, like focused on making this country well, making people well, just giving them the basics, giving them opportunities to have employment where they feel like that the work they're doing is meaningful and that they're contributing to something that they believe in. It's going to take a lot, but one of the other things I've been working on since that book is running or co-chairing a commission on the economy for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And part of what we did, it was this bipartisan commission of leaders across sectors in the country. And one of the things we did was listen to people across the country. We held a variety of listening sessions, and people of so many different backgrounds kind of said this similar tune of, you know, the economy is driven by greed and it's tough for me, you know, not just working class people, but people whom we would call middle class or even upper middle class sometimes were feeling like this is a grind. and it's just sucking the humanity out of me. And that's not sustainable. And when you, that kind of, that resentment is so widespread, and it's just fertile ground for someone to come in and say, you're right to be so pissed off, you know, vote for me and I'll whatever, drain the swamp.
Right. I alone can solve your problems.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why sometimes I say that capitalism tends to, unregulated capitalism tends to devour democracy, because the people who creates great disparities in wealth and income, and the super rich can buy their politicians essentially, and then the politicians pass bills that help the super wealthy, and everyone else is grinding it out. I mean, there was a study.
Here we are.
Yeah, there was a study by two political scientists, I'm sure you know their names, I've forgotten them, about what role the majority of people have in decisions that are made, and their conclusion was the majority doesn't rule almost all the time, that the people at the top are the ones who have the decisive influence, and if everyone, the only time that people in the majority get what they want is when the top 1% wants it to, you know, and so for a place that's called a democracy, that was a bit of a startling conclusion to see.
Yeah, that was Ben Page and Marty Gillins, and mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a super eye-opening study.
And so, then the question is, how do we fix that? And then what's the answer there?
If we only knew, Matt, right? I mean,
there's some chicken and egg things. I mean, campaign finance reform would be crucial, but how do we get to campaign finance reform with the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on corporations are persons and money is speech and Citizens United and all that? And so, those are real problems.
Right. I mean, that exactly, like, as you well know, right? I mean, fixing it, like change in legislation would go a long way. But that with Citizens United, I mean,
my hope is always with, and I used to work for Ralph Nader coming out of college. And then I was a student of Howard Zinn's, not literally, but metaphorically. And he wrote for me at the Progressive and Nader's big thing was citizen action as a counterforce. Howard Zinn's mm-hmm. was, protest as a counterforce. John Kenneth Galbraith in the 1950s was talking about unions as a counterforce, but they've been decimated. And Scott Walker led the way on that. And now Trump and government regulation has been a counterforce. And now, of course, Republicans have been going after that for a long time. And Trump is just being the latest on that, most aggressive. But when we don't have these countervailing powers, that's when the folks at the top win. But that's why I think protest is so important right now. What do you think about the efficacy of protest?
Well, I think it's important just even as you said earlier, for kind of signaling to other people in the community that there are other people who are not happy about what's going on and are willing to speak up and take some time out of their day to show up at the middle of town or the state capitol or what have you. I also think, when you were head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the referenda in counties around the state, right? Like, that is another way of, not binding in Wisconsin, right? But still a really important signal to lawmakers, but also it's a signal to other people in the public that there's a lot of discontent here, and these are your neighbors. They're right here. They're right in your midst. And they're feeling similar, that they want a different system.
Right. I mean, this was 57 out of 72 counties in Wisconsin passed referendums or resolutions at the municipal level saying that their community is against gerrymandering, wants to ban gerrymandering. And so it was an incredible grassroots effort. Some of it was spontaneous. Some of it was because of great organizing. But 57 counties, they're not 57 blue counties. They're not 47 or 37 blue counties. And also the idea of this is a blue county and this is a red county is something I recoil against, because in every county, there are people of every stripe and who are doing great work and trying to build a civic culture. I mean, I think of, the League of Women Voters, bless their hearts. They have chapters all over the state doing great work in a nonpartisan way. but supporting democracy. They're a very pro-democracy organization. So that's, you know, that's one way to go. And I do think starting locally, as you're suggesting here, and trying to, you know, build a movement. Again, there's still a Fair Maps movement going on all across the state. Mm-hmm. There's a movement in Wisconsin to overturn Citizens United. There have been resolutions or referendums passed in something like 170 communities saying, you know, we don't think corporations are persons and money is speech, and we're sick and tired of having our screens just splattered with mud all the time by this dirty money in our and dark money in our politics. So I do think at the grassroots we're seeing a resistance, and we're seeing the resistance to Trump too after the No Kings protest, and maybe that's what's going to save us in the long term.
Well, definitely is helping.
Yeah. I mean, how confident are you that we're going to get through this period, Kathy Kramer?
I'm super confident. I really am. I, for one part, like, there's no other option right now. Like, if you don't believe we're going to get through this, you're in a pretty dire situation mentally, right? But I also do believe we're going to get through this because, a friend, Tom Moskaller, who's just, you may know him, Matt. He is a longtime community organizer, just someone I really admire. He and Mike Brenninger just published this book called Pulling Together, about people working together at the local level across partisan line. Like, actually, partisanship is just irrelevant in what they're talking about, just the ability of people to come together and get things done for their community. He sent me yesterday a speech from the head of the Farmers Union from the 1930s. And it could have been written today, the things that this person was talking about in terms of the economy not working for the ordinary people and people not being represented. And I know the situation is different now. And I think that the communication environment is just a huge obstacle for people cutting through the noise and actually connecting with each other in a constructive fashion. But it was a huge reminder to me that we've been in a really tough spot before in this country. And the work of ordinary people focusing on talking with each other in small groups has gotten us through a lot. So once we can get away from the mob, I mean, this person was just emphasizing how important it is to talk with each other at a level where you're not shouting at one another, where you can actually have a conversation. It matters a lot. It goes a long way. And, you know, it might seem like the individual person is powerless, but right, like, how many social movements in the world have taught us that actually it starts with individual people doing the right thing
and talking,
seeing the humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry to interrupt. And talking person to person too. I mean, not just behind your screen, you know, but actually talking to people at the coffee house or at a poker game or at the book club or wherever you're at, engaging there just in civil conversation, that and engaging in protest. I think that's what that might save us after all, even though it seems pretty dire right now, as you suggested. Kathy Kramer, thanks so much for being my guest today on the Wisconsin Forward podcast. Great talking with you.
You too, Matt. Thank you so much for the conversation.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and thanks for listening to Kathy Kramer on this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast. In my next episode, I'll be interviewing Mike McCabe and a few others as we pursue the conversation on the so-called urban-rural divide. You won't want to miss that one.